This side is okay?
That's fine. Actually, no, you want to go through.
This way, huh?
Yeah, we can just leave this in here.
Okay. Thank you. So I have been given the task of talking about acute kidney injuries, formerly called acute renal failure. So let me ask you guys, what do you understand by this new terminology, acute kidney injury? What comes to your mind when you have somebody who, you know, whose BUN or creatinine or urine output has decreased? What do you make out of that? How do you assess somebody? You know, if you, you know, you checked your morning labs and or lab called you, creatinine is whatever, 5, and you found out that day before yesterday patient's labs were absolutely normal. How do you go on from there? Check the urine. What do you look for in the urine? CAS, okay. What kind of CAS do you look for? Muddy brown CAS, okay. What makes you think, you know, presence of muddy brown CAS in the urine makes you think of what? Can't hear. ATN, okay. So you guys think about ATN as the most common cause of acute kidney injury. That's right, or I'm wrong? Yes? And that is the commonest cause of acute kidney injury. You know, if you take epidemiologic studies and look at the etiology of acute kidney injury for patients coming to the hospital, ATN is the most common cause. So I'm glad to know that you guys know that ATN is the most common cause of acute kidney injury. How many of you know how to define acute kidney injury? Or what is acute kidney injury? Uh-huh. What is that some period of time? Is it over days? Is it over weeks? Is it over hours, months? Is there a time frame? So acute kidney injury is when you lose your glomerular filtration rate over a period of hours to days. So abrupt decline in your GFR is what defines as acute kidney injury. And there is a lot of controversy about exact definition of acute kidney injury. And that's what I'm going to go over. So basically what I'm going to talk about is some basic concepts about acute kidney injury. It's no more called acute renal failure because of, you know, some changes brought about by National Kidney Foundation to make a synchronization between chronic kidney disease and acute kidney disease. They have labeled acute renal failure to acute kidney injury. Some new you know, tests which are being looked at are still a research area for early diagnosis of acute kidney injury as compared to just looking for BUN and creatinine change. A little bit I'm going to touch on common causes of acute kidney injury, prerenal ATN and obstruction, and then a little bit of discussion about treatment, pharmacologic as well as renal replacement therapy, and then I have some questions for you to go over so that I can you know, find out how much you were able to comprehend my talk. So as I mentioned, acute kidney injury is basically an abrupt decline in your glomerular filtration rate, which is manifested clinically by retention of nitrogenous products. And unfortunately, right now, other than BUN creatinine, we have no other marker of making the diagnosis of acute kidney injury. So clinically, how we pick up the diagnosis is when we see somebody's BUN and creatinine changing very quickly after being in the hospital or after being followed up in clinic, that's when you make the diagnosis of acute kidney injury. So, you know, as I mentioned, there have been a lot of controversy. If you look at various epidemiologic studies, different definitions of acute kidney injury have been used in those studies. Some have used creatinine of change of 0.3, some have used creatinine of 0.5, some have used creatinine of 2, some have used baseline as normal, some have used baseline as abnormal value, and then take the change from there to make the diagnosis of acute kidney injury based on just serum creatinine. So to overcome that controversy from study to study, a panel of nephrologists and intensivists came up what is called as a uniform guideline to make the diagnosis and stratify the severity of acute kidney injury. This is called RIFL criteria, and RIFL basically stands for R is for risk, I is for injury, F is for failure, L is for loss, and E is for ESRD, where you become dialysis dependent. And this is just to walk you through various stages of renal failure when you have somebody in the hospital and give you just an estimate of how of the underlying severity of the disease. So this was this initiative was taken over by a Q Dialysis Quality Initiative, which is, as I mentioned, is nephrologists as well as ICU experts who sat together. And in this definition of acute kidney injury, the new criteria which got included was the urine output, which was never included in previous definitions of acute kidney injury. So based on this, risk is when you have somebody whose creatinine has increased by 1.5 times the baseline, or urine output is less than 0.5 ml per kilogram per hour for more than 6 hours. So that patient is going to go into failure if nothing is done to reverse this change in creatinine or urine output. Injury is when creatinine is more than twice the baseline value, or urine output has been at 0.5 ml per kilogram per hour for more than 12 hours. And the failure of the kidney is defined as 3 times the baseline creatinine, or GFR has declined by more than 75%, which is not, you know, included here, or your urine output is less than 0.3 ml per kilogram per hour for more than 24 hours, or you have been enuric for more than 12 hours. And I'll tell you what is enuria by definition. Loss is when you have persistent renal failure for more than 4 weeks, and end-stage renal disease is when you are dialysis dependent for more than 3 months. That's loss of your kidney function. So there have been problems. These are just guidelines. This RIFL criteria has not been tested into clinical studies. And to overcome the problem of loss and end-stage renal disease as well as urine output, actually Acute Kidney Injury Network came up with a modified form of RIFL criteria, which is the acute kidney injury, according to Acute Kidney Injury Network, is defined as that in this scenario, instead of having a big change of creatinine over a long extended period of time, they have defined as they have specified the time frame as 48 hours. And instead of having a large change in creatinine to include into your definition of acute kidney injury, smaller changes in creatinine have been included, because we all know from cardiac surgery post-op patients that even small changes in creatinines in epidemiologic studies in those patients are associated with a very high mortality rate at 30 days. So taken that criteria, even smaller change in creatinine has been included into this definition. So according to this network, the new definition of acute kidney injury is any abrupt increase in your serum creatinine of more than 0.3 milligram per deciliter, or 50% increase from your baseline, along with decrease in urine output of 0.5 ml per kilogram for 6 hours over a specified period of 48 hours is taken as acute kidney injury. So you can have either one of them, but to fulfill this criteria, you have to exclude two possibilities. One is that this criteria should be used only after you have volume resuscitated the patient, your patient is euvolemic. And if you're using only urine output as your criteria of acute kidney injury, you have to rule out obstruction, urinary tract obstruction in that patient. But if you have your creatinine, bump in creatinine, you don't necessarily exclude obstruction as cause of acute kidney injury. And according to this definition, the first three stages of RIFL criteria, which is injury, risk, and failure, are included into this definition, which is your change in your creatinine based on change. You can have stage one, which is the R part of the RIFL. Stage two is I, which is injury. Stage three is the failure part. And the loss and the end stage renal disease have been excluded from this definition. They are taken as outcome of acute kidney injury, not as part of acute kidney injury. So based on the urine output criteria, sometimes we like to classify patients into oliguric, enduric, or non-oliguric patients, because it just gives you an idea of the severity of underlying acute kidney injury. So oliguria is defined as a urine output less than 400 cc's per 24 hours. Non-oliguric acute kidney injury is urine output. Oliguric is less than 400. Non-oliguric is more than 400. And enuric is less than 50 cc's over 24 hours. And if you see patients from day to day in ICUs, you will see clinical expression of acute kidney injury is different from patient to patient. Some patients' level of their creatinine is around 2, 3, and some patients will continue to increase their load of azotemia till the level of around 11 or 12. So clinical expression, depending on the underlying severity of the medical problems, is different from patient to patient. And sometimes in patients who continue to urinate and we don't check labs from day-to-day basis, renal failure takes time to be diagnosed, and it will be only the load of azotemia which will tell you that patient has gone through this insult in last few days. Now, how common is acute kidney injury is dependent on how you define acute kidney injury. As I mentioned, there are number of definitions, numbers of levels of creatinine which are used in definitions. So if you take the definition as your change in creatinine more than 2 milligrams from your baseline in this study, which was published in JASN about 2 years ago, a study from Brigham where they looked at all the ER admissions coming to the hospital, taking the definition of acute kidney injury as more than 2 milligram rise in creatinine from baseline, the incidence, the new cases of acute kidney injury were only 0.5%. But if you lower your threshold for diagnosis of acute kidney injury from 2 to 0.5 milligram, your incidence of acute kidney injury can be as high as 12 to 15%. Unfortunately, like cardiologists, we don't have early markers of renal injury. We don't have still a renal troponin to make a very early diagnosis after you drop your blood pressure or you stop eating, drinking, or have vomiting or other losses. So a lot of research is going on looking at markers because serum creatinine takes time to increase, and there might be a lag of 3 to 4 days before you appreciate the change in creatinine. And unfortunately, by the time you guys realize the change in creatinine, a lot of damage does happen into the kidneys. So a lot of research is going on to find out very early markers of renal injury, which can help making an early diagnosis of acute kidney injury. And based on those levels, we may try to intervene and make clinical decisions about intervening in terms of renal replacement therapy, as well as applying some therapeutic modalities to our patients. So a few markers which have been looked at or are being looked at, one of them is cystatin C. And cystatin C is an endogenous molecule which is produced by almost all nucleated cells of the body, which is filtered. It's completely filtered and it's completely reabsorbed. And it can diagnose your acute kidney injury at least 2 to 3 days before you have a rise in your creatinine because of any insult which can throw your patient into acute kidney injury. Another molecule which is being looked at is kidney injury molecule 1, which is not expressed under normal circumstances, but if somebody is given a nephrotoxic agent or pre-renal azotemia is not reversed on time, patient goes through ischemic ATN. In those situations, a lot of KIM molecule is expressed on the surface of proximal tubular cells, and that KIM molecule, which is a transmembrane protein, undergoes proteolytic degradation, and the extracellular domains is excluded from the brush border of the proximal tubule. It goes out into the urine and can diagnose your acute kidney injury within 2 hours of onset of the insult. So, you know, this molecule may be used in near future as a very early marker of acute kidney injury. Along with KIM-1, there is another molecule which is being looked at, which is NGAL, which is neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalcin. Again, it's a substance which is produced, most of the time is found in association with neutrophil-associated lipocalcin, but it can be found produced by the liver, goes to the kidneys, and in situations of nephrotoxicity or ischemia, is produced in excessive amount by thick ascending loop of Henle, and increased expression and secretion into the urine can help in making the diagnosis of acute kidney injury much earlier than if you would just rely on serum creatinine. Interleukin, this is 18, not 8, is another molecule which is being looked at, but problem with interleukin 18 is that it takes time for interleukin expression to go up in proximal tubule after the onset of renal injury. So you may not be able to diagnose renal injury within 6 hours of onset of insult. Usually it takes 12 to 18 hours after the injury that the expression of and excretion of interleukin 18 goes up into the urine after onset of renal failure. So if you have to diagnose renal failure, acute kidney injury earlier on, KIM-1 and NGAL are the two molecules which will tell you, depending on the level under the area of curve, that the patient has gone through an insult and something should be done to prevent the patient from going into the failure part of acute kidney injury. And based on the levels of these molecules, as well as severity of the elevation, may help modulate the therapy of acute kidney injury. So whenever you have a patient who is in an acute kidney injury, you always have to figure out why patient is into acute kidney injury. So as you know, kidneys are very vascular organ. 25% of cardiac output goes through the kidney every minute. And to go through failure, something has to go wrong either with the cardiac output, which in turn will compromise, can't see from here, renal perfusion. And as less comes to the kidney, less work is done by the kidneys, and patients' nitrogenous products are not excreted, and there is elevation of BUN creatinine. If that's not the case, something has to go wrong with the structure of the kidney, the anatomical structures kidney is made of, that will give rise to acute kidney injury, and I'll tell you which structures you should be looking for. Or if nothing was wrong with perfusion or the structure of the kidney, but the drains of the kidneys are blocked by one or the other clinical entity, then whatever kidneys work has been done will end up in acute kidney injury if there was no free flow of the urine through the collecting system. So in terms of intrinsic causes of kidney acute kidney injury, as you know, kidney is made of tubules, interstitium, glomeruli, and vessels. So anytime you have a patient where you think that patient is having an intrinsic cause of acute kidney injury, you have to think about tubular structure being damaged, which is ATN, which is the commonest cause. And again, ATN can happen because of number of reasons. Can be ischemia, when you don't reverse the prerenal on time and you were not aware that patient was prerenal for one reason or the other. So that becomes ischemic ATN. You gave something toxic to the patient, which most of the time is induced by us in the hospital. So that gives rise to toxic ATN. Or there is some kind of mismatched blood transfusion, which is very unusual these days. So far, in my 10 years, I have seen only one patient who had mismatched blood transfusion and had hemoglobin urea. Or very commonly, you see this as a scenario in a patient who has alcohol on board or has been a cocaine user, has rhabdomyolysis, you have myoglobin urea, and in those situations you develop what is called as pigment-induced acute tubular necrosis. This makes at least 45% of cases of acute kidney injury. These causes are very uncommon cause of acute kidney injury. Does not mean you should not think about that, but you should pay attention to the common causes first before you proceed to the fancy causes of acute kidney injury. So how common are these various causes of acute kidney injury? If you can compare these two graphs, and you can see that ATN and prerenal still make a lot of cause of acute kidney injury. So if you know how to diagnose prerenal and ATN, you can independently manage 70% of patients on your own. You don't need renal to make that fancy diagnosis. And only rare situations where you have to have renal on board to make the diagnosis and provide the appropriate therapy according to what the underlying cause of acute kidney injury might be. So this is a study from Spain where they had looked at patients who were admitted through emergency room to the hospital with acute kidney injury. And you can see between 10 years of difference from 1977 to 80 to 1991, most of the causes of acute kidney injury remained prerenal to ATN, but between these two divisions, the new entity has been added, which is acute on chronic kidney injury, which we see more commonly now than we used to see years ago. So many and more patients get admitted where baseline creatinine is abnormal and they have an acute insult on top of that, where you stratify them into acute on chronic kidney disease, and then you have other causes which make up rest of the spectrum, but ATN remains still 45% of cases of acute kidney injury. And of the rare possibilities, only 10 to 15% cases you are going to think about rare possibilities, and this could be scleroderma, could be tumor obstruction, lymphoma involving the kidneys, secondary glomerulonephritis, vasculitis, and things like that. So do you have to think about different cause of acute kidney injury as you see patients from young to old age? Yes, you have to. The older the patient is, the more chances patient is going to be obstructed. 10% of cases of acute kidney injury can be from obstruction alone. So think about obstruction in every patient who goes through acute kidney injury, or you're entertaining as having acute kidney injury. It's something which you can diagnose right there and you can reverse it. Because if you don't reverse obstruction on time, permanent changes do take place in the kidneys, which will be irreversible, and your patient will be living with some kind of chronic kidney disease. So in young people, again, you can make out that prerenal and ATN are still the commonest cause, but as you age, obstruction takes over, and from 7 to 20% of cases in very elderly means patients who are above age of 75 will be from obstruction alone. Certain clinical scenarios where you should be very well alarmed that this patient might go through renal failure during this hospitalization or may have acute kidney injury at the time of admission are the presence of diabetes. Very commonly, you have diabetic patients who will have some kind of nephrotoxicity or some kind of insult during the hospitalization will predispose them to develop acute kidney injury. Patients who have pre-existing chronic kidney disease, again, as I mentioned, can develop acute kidney injury. Patients with volume depletion, multiple myeloma, patients who are being treated with diuretics during hospitalization, these are the situations you should be alarmed with when you may want to think that your patient is kind of predisposed to develop any acute insult. So prerenal azotemia can happen because of number of reasons. It doesn't have to be pure vomiting, pure diarrhea, poor PO intake that should make you think that this is prerenal azotemia. It could be either true hypovolemia or it could be effective circulating volume depletion, which kidney sense how much is coming to me, and that's how kidneys react to the perfusion by stimulating secondary homeostatic mechanisms. So think about this when you have a patient who has, he's giving you pure history of volume losses. You look at the BUN creatinine, you say, okay, patient is in acute kidney injury, and patient is in acute kidney injury because of true hypovolemia, and I'm going to give volume, and patient's kidney failure will reverse. That's most of the time what happens. But in some situations where you have decreased effective circulating volume, like in patients with severe heart failure, systolic versus diastolic, where you don't perfuse the body, you don't perfuse the kidneys, your patients will be going through acute kidney injury from prerenal azotemia because of poor cardiac output. Patients who undergo severe sepsis, even though they may not be looking volume depleted on exam, but effectively they are volume depleted because they have severe peripheral vasodilatation and their effective circulating volume is low as compared to their degree of peripheral vascular resistance, and kidneys will be sensing that there is less volume coming. In patients who have redistribution of volume status, like in patients with nephrosis, liver disease, patients with necrotizing pancreatitis, in those situations, even though your volume overloaded, but your circulating volume is low, and kidneys will sense as if less is coming, and they should hold on to BUN and creatinine, and numbers will look abnormal. In some situations, like in very elderly or patients who are effectively volume depleted, if you give them ACE inhibitors, sometimes you will see that their BUN and creatinine start climbing up because there is defect into the perfusion of the kidney. There is more efferent arteriolar dilatation as compared to efferent arteriolar dilatation. You drop your perfusion pressure and you goes into acute kidney injury. So think about all these scenarios. And as prerenal takes place, there are homeostatic mechanisms which kick in, which is your stimulation of renin angiotensin aldosterone feedback, as well as your stimulation of catecholamines, which will try to conserve as much sodium from the kidney as possible, as well as maintain your blood pressure to maintain the perfusion pressure to the kidney. So both myogenic neurohormonal systems kick in to maintain the perfusion, and in mild to moderate cases, if you restore the volume in appropriate time, your kidney failure will reverse. But if you don't do it on time, then there is chance that this ischemic injury at the level of the perfusion will progress to anatomic injury of the kidney, and you will develop a Q-tubular necrosis. Clinically, how do we diagnose? Like, you have patients where you have, some patients with pheochromocytoma, they secrete a lot of catecholamines. In that situation, you may have excessive vasoconstriction. And in that situation, you may precipitate, if you are effectively volume depleted at the time, acute kidney injury can happen in those patients. So how do you diagnose pre-renal azotemia? I'll go through it after I talk about acute tubular necrosis. Clinically, you have to think about the scenario which may have caused pre-renal azotemia, volume depletion, true or effective. And then you look at certain parameters, clinical, which will help you make the diagnosis. And then once you reverse the underlying etiology, as you reverse the etiology, the renal failure should start improving. And that by itself will prove that this was pre-renal azotemia. So if you volume resuscitated and renal failure did not reverse, then it's not pre-renal azotemia. Then you have to think about another cause of acute kidney injury. Nephrotoxic acute kidney injury can take place because of number of insults. Any medication in the world can cause acute tubular necrosis. Any renally excreted medication, if not used properly, ultimately can give rise to acute kidney injury. Some medications do it more often than the others, and the common one you guys should be aware of is the use of aminoglycosides, because you know that's used often, especially in patients who have sepsis. Vancomycin, IV contrast, which we subject our patients to when they come in, and you know, you will see your patients' numbers will get worse if you did not take precautions, especially in highly predisposed patient population. Patients who are given chemotherapeutic agents, some of them are nephrotoxic and will cause acute kidney injury as patient is being given chemotherapy. And these one we don't see except for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication. We don't use gold these days for treatment of rheumatoid. Penicillamine is not, has been long ago being used for rheumatoid arthritis. And the only one this one you guys don't see because we don't have transplant center here, but cyclosporin and tacrolimus are the other one which are nephrotoxic and give rise to acute kidney injury. Amphotericin on HIV service and on oncology service, especially for fungal sepsis, can be associated with acute tubular necrosis. So what happens in acute tubular necrosis is that you have either, as I mentioned, that can happen because there is ischemia from prolonged pre-renal, which wasn't reversed, or there is something which we gave to the patient which caused damage to the tubular cells. And as tubular cells get damaged, there is there is damage to the tubular epithelial cells, and the damage manifests itself by loss of the polarity of the cells. Cells are tethered to the basement membrane through certain tethering proteins. So as ischemia or toxin is given to the patient, that tethering proteins are lost from the basolateral end of the tubule, and they translocate to either the side of the membrane or a tubular cell or to the apical border of the tubular cell. Along with that tubular cells, they lose their brush border. As they lose their tethering protein, it's easier for them to detach themselves from the tubular basement membrane. So the tubular basement membrane becomes denuded. Cells are freely excreted into the tubular lumen, and that's what causes tubular blockage. And as tubular blockage takes place, the glomerular filtrate, which was formed, is reabsorbed through the naked basement membrane back into the peritubular capillaries. And then this what basically mediates the initiation phase of acute tubular necrosis, when you see every day's patient's creatinine is going up and up and up. And in some patients, it's followed by what is called as maintenance phase, which is usually 1 to 2 weeks, but in each patient is different. Some patients will take 2 to 3 days. Some patients may take longer than 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks to go through the maintenance phase. And this maintenance phase is followed by the recovery phase, where you see patients start making urine more and more as time goes on, and their numbers start declining, and that is manifested clinically by more urine output, changing chemistries, and into the histology of the kidney, these cells, which were not damaged at the time of insult, regenerate and they make new tubular epithelial cells, which ultimately reclaim their 100% physiologic function and cause a regeneration of the tubular epithelium. There has been a lot of debate about regeneration process of acute tubular necrosis. People initially thought that the regeneration process is initiated by the stem cells coming from the bone marrow. But latest experimental data has shown that these are the remnant unaffected tubular cells which stay after the injury, which are responsible for the regeneration of the tubular epithelial cells. So the decline in GFR or the increase in BUN creatinine, as I mentioned, happens because there is a ischemic injury, and most of the ischemia is patchy. If you biopsy somebody's kidney because of ATN, you will not see necrosis all over the place. It will be very patchy. Proximal tibules, some of the proximal tibules will be necrosed, some distal tibules will be necrosed. So it's a very patchy phenomena, and the reduction in the blood flow is mostly seen into the juxtaglomerular part of the kidney, where the medullary interstitium is already, as we know, is hypoxemic, and any insult with the renal blood flow is going to compromise that hypoxemic environment and cause damage to the tubular cells. So these tubular cells, as they slough off, they can cause obstruction. So there will be no flow of the urine through the nephron. These tubular cells can, as I mentioned, basement membrane is denuded, so there is back leak, there is a reabsorption of the glomerular filtrate, and as a result of the ischemia and tubular damage, there is an inflammatory response into the kidney, because these damaged tubular cells express a lot of proteins on their surfaces. Intercellular adhesion molecule is expressed, which attracts neutrophils. Once neutrophils get there, they express more molecules, and cytokines are released, and which mediate a lot of inflammatory response, which ultimately will cause a lot of damage into the ischemic environment. So renal failure from acute kidney injury, the retention of nitrogenous products is because of multiple reasons: obstruction, back leak of the glomerular filtrate, as well as vasoconstriction, which is because of imbalance between the vasodilator as well as vasoconstrictor mediators. So, as I mentioned, 10% cases of acute tubular necrosis, of acute kidney injury, can be from obstruction alone. So think about obstruction in every patient who walks in with abnormal BUN and creatinine to the hospital. So obstruction does not mean that it is only BPH. You have to think about every possibility of obstruction, starting from the renal tubule to the tip of the urethra. So sometimes you give medications to your patients which are likely to call crystals into the urine, and those crystals can block the renal tubules and can cause acute kidney injury just because of blockage of the tubules. So it's not only BPH or urethral stenosis or urethral stricture. It could be any medication causing crystaluria, and the common medications which can cause crystaluria, which we see from day to day in this hospital, are acyclovir. So intravenous acyclovir, if you are not very careful to a patient who is volume depleted, you give rapid infusion without encouraging PO intake or intravenous infusion over one period, prolonged period of time, or at least over 1 hour, can give rise to crystaluria and acute kidney injury. Other medications which you can think of? Sulfonamides, yes. Trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, as well as sulfadiazine, which sometimes you do use on HIV service for cerebral toxo, can be associated with crystaluria as well as nephrolithiasis. What else? What's that? Yes. Any other medications? Amphotericin usually is not associated with crystalluria. So commonly, the medications you should be aware of, other than what we spoke about, is huge doses of vitamin C. If you are over-treating somebody for chronic wound healing, and giving hefty doses of vitamin C can cause oxalate deposition and crystalluria as well as acute kidney injury. Methotrexate has been associated with crystalluria. Indenavir, which is not commonly used these days, but few years ago, many cases were attributed from Indenavir-induced crystallurgia as well as tubular interstitial nephritis. And in some situations, triamterin, which we use in our patients who may have, Liddle syndrome or severe hypertension, can be associated with crystallurgia and acute kidney injury. And anything down the drain, retroperitoneal fibrosis, ureteral clots, papillary necrosis, any cancer in the vicinity of the bladder, in the vicinity of the ureters, can be associated with obstruction and acute kidney injury because of obstruction alone. So think about it and try to rule it out in every case of acute kidney injury, because you can treat the injury right there if you find it. So what should one be doing once you have somebody who has, whom you think has acute kidney injury? As I explained before, you have to take a very thorough history from the patient. So history can include those predisposing conditions which I spoke about, looking for history of diabetes, diuretic use, ACE inhibitors in a patient where you might be suspecting acute bilateral renal artery stenosis, history or family history will walk you through some rare genetic disorders. And then taking a detailed medication history from the patient will help you figure out if you something you gave to the patient or patient might be taking at home might have predisposed the patient to develop acute kidney injury. Then you review hospital records while patient is in the hospital. If you did not find anything in the history, looking for vitals. Have vitals been unchanged since admission? Any episodes of hypotension, tachycardia, fevers, all that give you a clue that this patient might have been having fluid losses because of change in clinical scenario. Looking for ins and outs to have an idea whether the patient has been positive or negative. You have been diuresing the patient, so negative losses will make you think that this patient might have become intravascularly dry, and that might be the reason patient is in acute kidney injury. Body weights again will help you, losing weight versus as compared to gaining weight, making you think this is volume overload versus hypovolemia. And then looking for other evidence, white count, blood cultures, giving you an idea whether there is any ongoing sepsis or not. After you do your history and hospital records, you have to examine your patient, and examination of your patient should include checking the blood pressure and pulse both in supine and sitting position if you're thinking that this might be prenatal azotemia. So orthostasis is something good to rule out in your patient. And if you have done that, skin turgor, again, giving you a clue whether your patient is volume depleted, which may not be a reliable sign in very elderly patient because, that skin is less elastic in elderly patient and can tent off very easily. If you have done that, looking into eyes sometimes is helpful, looking for changes of hypertension and diabetes, and as well as if your patient is being treated for bacteremia or endocarditis, you can have evidence of embolization by looking into the eye. Lung examination is good to look for evidence of volume overload. A heart exam, again, looking for JVD, volume overload, heart failure, S3, pericardial rub to have an assessment whether your patient, if in acute kidney injury, has any evidence of uremia, and you may want to initiate renal replacement therapy based on your exam. Vascular exam is very important, looking for purpura, if this is maybe a case where you might be entertaining vasculitis. And, write any routine exam, you examine your patient from head to toe, looking for clues to make the diagnosis of acute kidney injury. So you may or may not find anything on exam, but unless you do it, you cannot, accumulate points to make the most likely diagnosis of acute kidney injury. And once we have done that, then we do use certain tools to make the diagnosis of underlying cause of acute kidney injury. And the two major tools which we use is, one is urine analysis, and the other one is fractional excretion of sodium. So, you tell your colleagues to go ahead and collect the urine and send it for urinary sodium and urinary creatinine because you want to see what kidneys are doing in terms of function. And along with that, depending on what you're thinking of as an underlying cause of acute kidney injury, you may end up ordering more tests to find out if your patient is having another cause of acute kidney injury. So if you're thinking of vasculitis or glomerulonephritis, you may end up sending off some blood tests to look for underlying cause of acute glomerulonephritis or vasculitis. So ANA, complements, ANCA's, anti-GBM disease, if you have somebody coming in with blood, hemoptysis or blood-stained sputum, shortness of breath. So in those scenarios, you will order pertinent tests, but they don't need to be done on every single case of acute kidney injury. So it depends what you're thinking of underlying cause and then ordering the tests according to that. So, but as I mentioned, obstruction is something which you need to rule out. So if you put in a Foley in your patient and you didn't get more than 100 cc's after you put in a Foley, does not mean your patient cannot have upper urinary tract obstruction. You still need to do the imaging study to make sure that their patient is patent both in the upper as well as in the lower urinary tract. So ultrasound becomes an essential part of diagnosis of acute kidney injury. So what do we do with the urine after you guys give us a urine specimen? We like to look under the microscope to narrow down our differential for acute kidney injury. So depending on what we are seeing in the urine, it will lead us in one direction or the other. So if you have normal analysis, you spun the urine for the right period of time at the right speed, and you took out the sediment and you looked under the microscope, you didn't find much. Good news. Your patient can have either pre-renal or your patient can have post-renal. Those are the two major differentials you have to think about. If you had abnormal BUN and creatinine in somebody who had normal renal function before, bland sediment is good news that something can be done for the patient to reverse it. But if you have taken the sediment and if you're seeing different things, it will lead you one direction or the other. So if you're seeing RBCs in the sediment of your patient, then most likely you're dealing with a case of either glomerulonephritis or vasculitis. But make sure your patient did not just have the Foley catheterized, because sometimes because of the Foley, you can see some trauma into the urinary tract and you can have some hematuria right after you spin the urine in that particular patient. So if this is a patient who had a Foley put in 3 days ago and now I'm seeing RBCs, which look kind of abnormal on morphology, GN and vasculitis is high on the list. If you're seeing mostly WBCs, especially in a company with bacteria, that should make you think that you're dealing probably with UTI, and that should be excluded before you start interpreting pyuria as cause of acute kidney injury. So if you see WBC along with WBC cast, most likely if infection is ruled out, then interstitial nephritis is the underlying cause of acute kidney injury. If you see a lot of eosinophils in a patient who does not have pyelonephritis, then most likely you are dealing with some kind of allergic interstitial nephritis from one of the medications, or you have atheroembolization as the cause of acute kidney injury. A lot of renal tubular epithelial cells, remember I showed you cells which denude themselves from the tubular basement membrane. Sometimes you can see those cells as well as clumps of those cells, casts of those cells into the urine. So if you did not see muddy brown cast into the urine, but you're seeing a lot of renal tubular epithelial cells, that's another evidence that your patient is going through acute tubular necrosis. So if you see a lot of those cells, it should make you think that this is acute tubular necrosis. If you see crystals, depending on what type of crystals you are seeing, uric acid versus oxalate crystals versus acyclovir crystals, should make you think one or the other as the cause of acute kidney injury. And if you see nothing much, but there is only low-grade proteinuria, then you think about, rare possibilities like multiple myeloma as the underlying cause of acute kidney injury, myeloma kidney especially. So I mentioned that when do we see? Usually the clinical scenario is somebody who is going for a vascular study. So patients who is going for abdominal angiogram, peripheral angiogram, or sometimes we see it spontaneously in patients who have been started on systemic anticoagulation for one reason or the other, that patient's creatinine start going up, patient has high amylase, lipase, GI bleeding, livedo reticularis. Usually it's a multi-system disease. Isolated kidney atheroembolization is very unusual to be seen. But when you see atheroembolization, it's usually a systemic process. You have skin involvement, you have pancreas, GI, liver, kidneys. So our eyes, these are the usual areas where you look into to make the diagnosis of atheroembolization. So the urine indices which we use other than spinning the urine is sending the urine for fractional excretion of sodium. And why fractional excretion of sodium is important? Because it functional abnormality of the kidneys you can pick up by doing the functional test, which is how much sodium is being retained by the kidneys in a patient who is effectively volume depleted. So if your patient is hypovolemic, you expect that kidney to reclaim as much sodium from the kidney as possible so that most of the extracellular volume can be restored. So you expect that patient to excrete very small amount of sodium into the urine. So if you do urinary sodium in that patient's urinary sodium is going to be low. And if you do fractional excretion, it's going to be less than 1% in a patient who has hypovolemia as the cause of, or prerenal azotemia as the cause of acute kidney injury. Whereas in patients who have acute tubular necrosis, tubules are necrosed, cells don't know what to do. Even though you are volume depleted, your cells have lost their functional capability of reclaiming sodium, so there will be sodium wasting. Usually urinary sodium in ATN is more than 40, and usually your FeNA is more than 2%. Between 1 and 2, you could still be in the transition zone, and if you intervene during that stage, you might be able to reverse acute kidney injury even at that point. So some other tests which we look at other than just looking at the fractional excretion of sodium, and I'm assuming you guys know how to do fractional excretion of sodium. You don't. They will be asking you in boards, not even in day-to-day life. They will not give you formula, so you better start doing it in your brain all the time when you have somebody with acute kidney injury. So sometimes we do look at specific gravity. Again, same homeostatic mechanism which will conserve sodium will release ADH from the posterior pituitary. And as you release ADH, you expect all the water in the urine to be reabsorbed, and urine specific gravity is usually high in a patient with prerenal azotemia as compared to a patient who has acute tubular necrosis. Same pathophysiology applies to high urine osmolality in prerenal as compared to ATN. And in some situations, we do fractional excretion of urea or uric acid or lithium, again looking for evidence, especially in situations where your patient is on diuretic therapy and you are not sure if this is prerenal because patient just took the dose of diuretic in the morning, then you may want to do fractional excretion of urea to differentiate between prerenal versus acute tubular necrosis. Some other clues in the history physical as well as in your lab parameters which make you think that this is prerenal versus ATN is one is that ratio of BUN to creatinine. As we know, in prerenal state, there is nothing wrong with the tubules. Tubules are trying to reclaim as much sodium from the proximal tubule as possible. And proximal tubule sodium is reabsorbed in conjunction with urea. So in any in prerenal azotemia, whenever you have low sodium, you expect that patient's uric acid as well as urea to be high. And that's the underlying reason why you should be looking for a BUN creatinine ratio to be high, more than usually 20 to 1. Normal ratio being between 10 to 15, anything more than 20 should make you think that you might be dealing with some prerenal azotemia. So some clinical scenarios which you guys should be aware of that can give rise to high BUN creatinine ratio, or you have prerenal picture but you still don't have high BUN creatinine ratio, should not make you think that this is not prerenal azotemia. So think about scenarios where you have patient is not eating. If patient is not eating, patient is not taking proteins, you're not making BUN. Patient who has problem with the liver, your BUN is made in the liver. So if factory is wrong, defective, BUN is not produced. So even though patient is dry, you don't see the ratio, do not exclude the diagnosis of prerenal azotemia. Same thing with patients who have who had done dialysis and things which will artificially lower your BUN. In high ratios, think about scenarios, patients on steroid therapy can have high BUN. Patients who are on tetracyclines can have high BUN. Patients who have GI bleeding can have high BUN. So all these scenarios should go through your mind. Not a single test of these will make the diagnosis. You have to put things together, accumulate points to make the diagnosis of prerenal versus ATN. And this is just to show you that by the time you guys realize that you appreciate the change in creatinine, how much change in GFR takes place when your creatinine becomes abnormal to the point that you guys pick it up, that something is wrong with patient's kidneys. So between 1 and 2, you already lose 50 cc's of GFR, which is a very large amount of number to be lost So even small changes in creatinine, as I mentioned before, after cardiac surgery, 1 to 1.1 to 1.2, 30-day mortality rate goes several fold up. So people are paying now more and more attention to even small changes in serum creatinine. And between 2 and 4, you can see the change in creatinine is, GFR is not as drastic as between 1 and 2. And as number goes up, we get more panicky because number is increasing, but in terms of true GFR, the change is not that tremendous. So what do you do? Unfortunately, we don't have very skillful tools to treat renal failure, acute kidney injury. Even though, you know, so many years have passed by, what we look for in a patient with acute kidney injury is pre-renal, which we can reverse, obstruction, which can be reversed. We can reverse if this is a urologic issue, then we need services from urology. But in other cases, ATN, we have not made any significant improvement when it comes to therapy of acute kidney injury. So there are some tools which you can use here and there, but most of the time they don't work. If you look at their trials of these agents, most of the data looks very dismal. So what can we use if we have a patient who is not making urine, whose numbers are going up? So surgeons like to use this agent, but if you look at literature looking at dopamine all by itself compared to placebo, dopamine being compared to other agents in low dose as well as in high dose, in retrospective, prospective, randomized trials, dopamine is out as an agent to improve your glomerular filtration rate, renal vasodilatation, and improvement in your renal function. So dopamine, from medical point of view, is not used, should not be used in acute kidney injury. Phenoldipam, because it's more selective as compared to dopamine, it acts onto the D2 receptors. It causes with renal vasodilatation. It improves your glomerular filtration rate. So in non-diabetics as well as in some if you look at some literature about contrast-induced nephropathy, prevention of contrast-induced nephropathy, it may be something which you can use in a patient who is going through high risk clinical situation where patient is predisposed to develop acute tubular necrosis. Diuretics, the only thing I will say about diuretics is that if you look at data of use of Lasix, because your Lasix, as you know, blocks your sodium, potassium, chloride channel in thick ascending loop of Henle. There have been hypotheses in the past that if you block that channel, you may actually conserve the energy into the kidney, because as I mentioned, most of the loss of the renal blood flow happens into the juxtaglomerular part of the kidney. So in that hypoxic environment, if you can conserve energy, then you may be able to accelerate the healing of acute tubular necrosis. But again, data is all over the place, and in some studies, actually use of diuretics is associated with a worse outcome. So if your patient is oliguric and your patient, you want to hemodynamically stable and you want to see if you can make your patient pee, and if you give a good dose of diuretic and your patient is not able to mount a urine output after a good dose of diuretic, then I will stop right there. There is no need that patient should be challenged time and again with diuretic to see if we can make the patient urinate. It just tells you that patient has no residual nephrons where your Lasix could work and you could convert your oliguric into non-oliguric ATN. It just gives you a severity of situation. So usually it's taken as a poor marker of outcome when your patient does not respond to a good dose of diuretic while going through oliguric acute tubular necrosis. ANP, again, ANP does work short term. If you're looking at hours after establishment of acute kidney injury and urine output, yes, it does work, but there is no sustained response to ANP. So trials, long-term data, 1 month, 3 weeks, 4 weeks after use of ANP, there's no major change, statistical benefit of using ANP in established cases of ATN. As I mentioned, those cells which remain unaffected from the injury do de-differentiate. They undergo growth and they regenerate the tubules after the insult is over. So people have looked at use of certain growth factors while patient is going through acute kidney injury, because the growth of those remaining tubular cells is under effect of certain growth factors like hepatocyte growth factor, epidermal growth factor, insulin-like growth factor. So people have used insulin-like growth factor as well as thyroxine, but again, data is not promising. It does work in experimental animals, but when it comes to humans, there's no benefit of using these growth factors so far for recovery of ATN. So then, you know, patients, again, if the load of azotemia is increasing, there is going to come to a point where you have to think about to become invasive from non-invasive to invasive therapy and initiate your patient on some kind of renal replacement therapy. So the concept of renal replacement therapy has changed over years. Before, BUN of 110 of creatinine were taken as absolute numbers to think about starting patient on dialysis. But these days, even with BUN of 40 and creatinine of 2, you may see patients in the units, especially in surgical ICU, being started on renal replacement therapy. So concept of indications of acute renal replacement therapy and acute kidney injury has changed a lot. And sometimes people believe in what is called as prophylactic dialysis, where you don't have to become clinically azotemic to think about being on renal replacement therapy. So what types of therapies we have available these days? We have intermittent hemodialysis, which we use most of the time on patients who are into acute kidney injury on the floors, as well as stable patients in ICUs. Those who can withstand every other day hemodialysis are the ones who undergo this intermittent therapy. Continuous renal replacement therapy is something which we use in patients who are hemodynamically unstable, where they are not able to take the stress of short period of dialysis over 3 or 4 hours. So those are the ones who will undergo chronic renal replacement therapy. PD has been used in acute kidney injury, but problem with PD is that it's associated with a lot of complications. It's costly. It's associated with abdominal distension, especially in patients who have COPD. It may not abdominal catastrophe. You may not be able to use it as the effective therapy. Extended daily dialysis is something which has been used in the past, but this has been taken over by SLED, which is low efficiency dialysis, where we put our patients, it's a regular hemodialysis machine which has a special chip where you can lower the blood flow rate and the dialysis flow rate to very low values, and you can dialyze your patients for 12 to 16 hours depending on, you know, availability of the ICU nurse as well as how long your patient is going to be in ICU without going to radiology or angio suite for any procedure or so. So low efficiency dialysis is just like having your CRRT, but in CRRT you have lots of fluid management going back and forth, but in SLED it's just the slow hemodialysis which takes place over 12 to 16 hours. Any questions so far? No? So, you know, I don't want to go into dose of dialysis indications. From your point of view, you should know when to use CRRT and when to use intermittent hemodialysis. So I brought some questions with me just to go over, you know, differential of a patient who you may be coming across from day-to-day admissions from the ER. So this is a 77-year-old female who presents with weakness and anorexia and fatigue for 1 week. She had labs done 1 month ago where she had symptoms which were suggestive of viral infections. At the time, the plasma creatinine was 1 milligram per deciliter, and now she's admitted because of increasing symptoms of viral illness. Physical examination shows blood pressure of 150-100. Remainder of the examination is non-contributory. So, you know, there's no rash, there is no edema. So these are her numbers. BUN is 98, creatinine is 10. Sodium is 140, plasma potassium is 4.6, hemoglobin is 29, and urine analysis is only trace protein by dipstick, and the sediment is benign. So what would you think, whether this is acute versus chronic? What do you think is the clinical scenario you're dealing with? Is this chronic kidney disease? Why not? You have values here, right? 1 month ago, her creatinine was 1, right? So within a month, something happened to this lady. So there is change in her GFR, which is reflected as a change in her serum creatinine. So from 1 to 10 over a period of 1 month is not chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease is presence of abnormal either anatomic, physiologic, or lab value for more than 3 months. So she does not fulfill the criteria of chronic kidney disease. So this is acute kidney injury by definition. We don't have the right time frame to tell you that this happened within 48 hours because we don't have labs from within 48 hours. But for all practical purposes, you have to say that this is acute kidney injury. So now, with this, her urine analysis being benign under the microscope, what would you think that might have caused this change in her BUN and creatinine? Or what could be the cause of her acute kidney injury? What's that? So, as I mentioned, if you have bland sediment, you have to think about two possibilities as the most likely cause of acute kidney injury. It could be pre-renal, it could be post-renal. So, pre-renal, you will look for a scenario where she might have become truly volume depleted, which is not reflected here, that even though she's weak, she's tired, she may or may not be eating enough. It's a possibility, but we don't have a clear-cut history where there is vomiting, there is diarrhea, there is GI, other GI loss, anti-suction, things like that. So our obstruction, given that she's 77 years old, she's old, she's likely to have any uterine prolapse, any cervical CA, we don't know what her previous workup has been primary care-wise, so you would think about that this may be a case of post-renal versus pre-renal acute kidney injury. So those should be kept in high on your list. So in terms of, is this patient in homeostasis? Do you see these numbers in a patient? So far, patient is able to maintain her sodium, her potassium, her bicarb. Bicarb is not given here. But so far, sodium and potassium appear pretty much normal. So how will you make the diagnosis in this patient? What tests will you do? You spun the urine doesn't tell you. So what other tests could you do? What other tests would you do? I said renal has only two tools. One is you spun the urine. Urine doesn't help you. Was that? Yes, so, you know, order some more tests. So send a urine sodium, send urine for creatinine, calculate the FeNA, and see what it is. On exam, she doesn't look like she's dry. History is not compatible with volume depletion. So doing a FeNA will help you. So if you see a FeNA of less than 1%, the clinical scenarios which you could be dealing with other than pre-renal azotemia, which you should be knowing as cause of low FeNA, is acute glomerulonephritis. Because of severe intense intrarenal vasoconstriction, your FeNA is low in acute glomerulonephritis. Patients who undergo CT scan with IV contrast-induced nephropathy, within 48 hours when their creatinine goes up, that's associated with low FeNA, but you have ATN on the sediment. Patients who have acute obstruction, just started with obstruction, in the initial phase of obstruction, FeNA is low because your tubules are reabsorbing all the sodium coming to them. And in some situations of very few cases of acute interstitial nephritis, your FeNA can be low. And hepatorenal syndrome, I'm assuming you guys know that it's a pre-renal-like state, so FeNA is low in hepatorenal syndrome. So whenever you have low FeNA, if you didn't find the right scenario for pre-renal, think about these possibilities which will help you make the diagnosis of underlying cause of acute kidney injury. Okay, let's do this case. This is a 74-year-old... can I do one more? It's 6:10. I can? Okay. So 74-year-old man with diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, baseline creatinine of 1.7, undergoes coronary angiography. 48 hours later, which is not uncommon, the procedure, his creatinine is 1.8. 1 week later, he's readmitted to the hospital with abdominal and lower extremity muscle pains. His serum creatinine is 3.6. His amylase is elevated to 320 with a CPK of 470. His urine specific gravity is 10-12 with one blood and two plus protein on by dipstick. Microscopic examination reveals 3 to 5 RBCs per high power field, rare white cells, and moderate number of fine granular casts. What is the most likely etiology of this patient's acute kidney injury? Is this contrast-induced nephropathy? This is atherosclerotic disease. This is myoglobinuric acute kidney injury, prerenal azotemia, and vasculitis. A is contrast-induced nephropathy. How many of you think this is contrast-induced nephropathy? Why do you think this is contrast-induced nephropathy? There is a setup. Patient had coronary angiogram. IV contrast was given. He has certain predisposing factors, which is he has hypertension. He has underlying chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease alone by itself is the most important risk factor to develop contrast-induced nephropathy. So you have high-risk situation where he had coronary angiogram, but what is the definition of contrast-induced nephropathy? His creatinine 48 hours after the procedure is 1.8. His baseline is 1.7. Definition of contrast-induced nephropathy is change in creatinine of more than 0.3 milligram per deciliter 48 hours after the procedure. So this guy does not fulfill the criteria of contrast-induced nephropathy. So I will exclude, based on definition, contrast-induced nephropathy. How about atherosclerotic disease? What procedure was done on this patient? Vascular procedure or non-vascular procedure? Vascular procedure. I told you atheroembolization usually takes place after a vascular intervention. And as I mentioned, it's a multi-system disease. It's not one single organ. You will not see only pancreas or only kidney being involved. You will see usually systemic embolization. And when you see, I mentioned skin is number one organ, pancreas, GI tract, liver, and then kidneys. So look at this guy. His amylase is 320. His muscle has been involved. He has a little bit of rhabdo. And then along with that, his creatinine has been changing. And the time frame for the change of creatinine is not what you would expect in a patient with contrast-induced nephropathy. And look at his urine specimen. His urine sediment shows only rare white cells. It's, you know, usually you do see pyuria in patients who have atheroembolization, but you don't see pyuria, should not make you think that this is not atheroembolization. So this is a case of atheroembolic disease. How about myoglobinuric acute kidney injury? Is this a case of rhabdo? Why not? So usually by the time you see renal failure from rhabdomyolysis, usually your CPKs are in thousands, hundreds of thousands. So 470 of CPKs does not predispose you. Load of myoglobin is so low, it will not cause obstruction as well as nephrotoxicity. How about prerenal azotemia? Do you see prerenal azotemia 3 weeks after you had the procedure done? And the clinical scenario, you know, there is no clinical situation which is making you think that you might be dealing with prerenal azotemia. How about vasculitis? Why would you exclude vasculitis in this patient? Based on what? This is how you have to tackle questions. You have to use your logic, process of elimination, to come to the right answer. I know this is not the right answer, but why are you excluding vasculitis? You should know. What should be the urine sediment in a patient who has vasculitis? Vasculitis means vessels are involved. There is inflammation going on within the vasculature. Could be microvasculature, could be macrovasculature. So you expect to see some hematuria. Sometimes you see hematuria all over the place. Sometimes it could be just few RBCs. So, you know, given that this patient has no RBCs on the sediment, and usually you have a lot of proteinuria as well if you are dealing with vasculitis. But could be 2 plus, 3 plus. So, and then you have a prodrome and, you know, systemic illness, which will make you think that you might be dealing with vasculitis. So based on that, I will exclude vasculitis. So diagnosis in this patient is atheroembolization. So time frame will tell you. I mean, I had a lot to talk about, but in terms of time, I'm kind of constrained. So maybe next time. Okay? Thank you. Take this off.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
That was great.
Thank you.